Everyone for being present on such short notice. This morning, we're going to start with Kathy, is it Foligno? Foligno, is that correct? The Secretary of State's Audit Division. And your name, sir?
Kathy.
Great. And go over some extent the audit accomplished by the Secretary of State's office and tell us what your general impressions are and perhaps where we should go from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathy Foligno, Director of the Secretary of State Audit Division. And with me is Chuck Kibner, Deputy Director of the Audit Division. We released two audits back in January of 2002. One that dealt with encounter data, and I'd be happy to go through that audit, and another audit looking at eligibility issues. It's our understanding that the committee has some interest in hearing about these two audits. So what we do have prepared is a real brief, high-level summary on these audits, which we'll go ahead and give and then field any questions that you might have.
All right. That's
okay. Great. I believe you have copies of both of these audits in your handout. I'm going to start with the audit that's titled Department of Human Services, Oregon Medical Assistance Program Encounter Data Review. And let me give you just a little bit of background to help set the stage for this audit. The Oregon Health Plan differs from traditional Medicaid in that services are provided primarily through managed care plans. This approach provides a pre-specified amount for each client, regardless of the amount of services that they actually receive. Payments are made on a monthly basis to these plans based on the number of enrollees, and these payments are intended to cover the cost of those services. One of the program requirements is that these managed care plans report back to the state the actual services that they do provide to the client. The information that they report back is what we call encounter data. And this encounter data really is used to make a number of management and policy decisions, but primarily amongst those is the setting of those rates that we do pay to the managed care plan.
Sure.
Is that information standardized from contract to contract with providers so that it's the same information coming?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, yes, it's standardized. One of the things we did find during this review is that there are some things in the contract with them that can be improved. One of the things we note in the audit is that prescription drug information wasn't the required report from these plans, and that made up, about a fifth of the managed care payments can be attributed to prescription drugs. So that's one of the recommendations in the report is to make sure that you're getting all the information you need to properly separate. So what we did do, the purpose of this audit was to look at, one, is it important to have accurate, reliable encounter data? And two, if it is important, is the state doing what they need to do to make sure that the information coming in is reliable? So basically the first question, is it important? We found that yes, encounter data is important that we do have accurate, reliable encounter data because very, very small percentage error rates result in very large dollar impact. And we put in the report, just to give you an example of the fungibility of this number, a 5% error rate translates into about a $65 million error. So the accuracy of this information is very important. This number has been confused that we said that there is a 5% error rate, but what we wanted to show is that it's important to have good data because there's large dollar impact to that data. So answer to question number one, yes, it's important to have good data. Question two was we went out to look at what is the state doing to ensure that we do have good data. The federal government provides really four basic areas to ensure that you have good encounter data. We did some testing in three of those four. One of them is the one that we didn't test in had to do with computer system edits and audits. We've done prior audit work in that area in the past, so we can focus on the more manual controls in this audit. We found opportunities for the state to do a better job in all three of the other areas that we looked at. The important point I want to make here, though, is that the unanswered question, kind of the next big thing that needs to be asked, is how far off is it? That's not answered in our audit. What our audit did was found that we currently have a need to make some changes so that we can secure better data in the future. So we focus on those recommendations to help get better information in the future. But what we don't know today, and what really nobody knows, is the quality of the data that we have right now to make those rates is unknown. And that's kind of an unanswered question that needs to be answered. next, which is how far off is it. So that was the purpose of this audit, was is it important, and, you know, are we doing all we need to get good information? And so that's where the audit is at.
All right, Senator.
No, we found out that we clearly are off on the data. We don't have accurate data, but are we so far off on the data that we've got a major problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, again, that's the big
but
question.
We don't know.
Some of the stuff that we saw would indicate that the rates should go down based on what we saw. Other things we saw indicate that the rates should go up. And so you don't know exactly where we're at right now. Kind of the next logical step that would need to take place is a review to see how it is.
Sometimes when you get to the place where you determine that you need to do something, the fix is more expensive than the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So do you factor that in?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, that is a great point. And again, we don't know. That's the problem. We don't know how far off it is. What would need to take place to get to that question is, you know, what we'd have to do is a statistical sample of those encounters that were reported, and have those encounters traced back to actual medical shots, which is a extensive review, but it can be done. And just to give you a real brief example, last year my son stuck a rocket to his nose in the preschool kindergarten. I took him into the emergency care clinic. They sucked the rock out of his nose. When I got the insurance report back, it came back as some form of surgery that they did on him. So in order to review that encounter, the information coming in, somebody would actually have to take that form of surgery, which would be all that the state would see, and actually trace it back to the medical chart and have some kind of medical knowledge to know this is what happened out there and this is how it should be reported back to the state. That's something that we don't have the expertise as auditors to do. We've done a similar review in the past looking at hospital billings, and we had to hire a contractor to help us out to do the medical necessity piece of that review. So that's really kind of what would need to take place. If we were asked, or if somebody was asked to do it, somebody with the medical knowledge to be able to go in, look at those charts, compare it to the encounters, and do that with this.
Excuse me, Senator Shields.
I was just wondering, you know, you're gathering all this data, and or the plans are supposed to be gathering it all. Is data accurate enough so that the cavitation rates are appropriately set, or are they too big, little, high, low, whatever the term would be?
Senator Shields, that's the question that nobody knows. We know that systematically we don't have all the steps in place to do all that we can do as a state to ensure the data is good.
Okay.
But the unanswered question is, how good is it?
But what I'm saying is, at the one hand, there's a question where we would be saying, hey, maybe we're paying these guys too much. The other end, if the capitation rates are wrong, maybe we're not paying them enough, is what I'm driving at. And it's a two-sided coin, and you don't have the data to answer either side of the coin, is what you're saying.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator, because we know that there's problems. We don't know how big the problem is. And let me maybe explain also, too. There's another piece to this. Encounter data is used to set a base rate, and then it's also, which kind of establishes how big a pie the state pays out to these managed care plans. And then on top of it, each plan gets an adjustment based on the level of their encounters within the group that they're serving and cost of living in their area. So, of course, they make an adjustment to the Portland area. They also make an adjustment based on the services that a certain group receives. So the encounter data sets the size of the pie, but it also sets how big a slice of pie each plan gets. And so if one plan does a good job reporting their data, another plan doesn't do quite as good a job, it may impact the slice of pie that they get. So there's two shifts that occur. You may have some plans that are making out great, you may have some plans that aren't, and it's simply a matter of the quality of that information. But again, that's the next logical question. We saw some things that would make the rates go up, some things that would make the rates go down, but where that balance is would need that statistical sample to take a look at.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't reviewed this since we had it in the leadership help committee. I don't remember. Did you interview a lot of the people, the plans that have already gone out of business because of the lack of reimbursement rates that kept them in business?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrell, if I may, Chuck Dibner, Deputy Director. During our audit step, we did talk to a couple of the plans, one of them that was considering going out of business and one that had, I believe. Of course, their representation at that time was that the rates were not paying enough for them to remain in business. We had no way to confirm that. We just report that as information.
The second question, is there anyone that's, I guess I would say, anyone reported to you that they're making enough money they feel stable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrell, we don't know. I would assume that there are some that they would go out of business if they weren't making money. So that's just an assumption on my part.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fact is, well, we've had so many go out of business because they cannot operate with the reimbursement rates they had. Makes me wonder if, I mean, not only are the problems with the encounter data, but also with the reimbursement rates. Thank you.
Did you say there was an adjustment by region in Portland metro area, downstate
Nam? They make an adjustment based on a geographic adjustment, but they also make an adjustment based on population curve.
So one possible question would be whether or not we're having providers opting out or closing down who are already in, say, rural areas as opposed to the Portland metro area, whether there's a appropriate adjustment of those numbers for the region. Mm-hmm. That's just one possible question. I wanted to ask you a kind of a general question, though, about the expectations that you have as an auditor and what you generally look for. And I don't want to be theatrical here, but there's been a lot of criticism of private corporations with respect to financial accountability. Mm-hmm. And knowing the direction of a particular corporation and its stewardship over the shareholder interests in the corporations. And as a public official, to me, we are the board of directors in the essence of $30+ billion worth of programs, which is fairly large. And what I hear you saying to me is that the data that we have is so inaccurate as to provide us with virtually no guidance with respect to the financial accountability of this program, which has been in existence since at least 1993 and proceeding signing in the 91 session of the legislature. So it raises some questions about the fiduciary responsibilities that public officials have with these resources and our relationship with our federal partners here. So can you share with me, in looking at these audits and your role here, what you think might need to be done to improve this data and whether or not you're getting an appropriate response from various public officials? And also, is there any paper trail or documentation where your agency, the Secretary of State's office, may have asked that the directors of these agencies or program managers change certain financial accountability standards or practices? There have been any requests of that nature, and have they been honored or responded to appropriately? And is there an enforcement mechanism to those things? It's kind of a long question, but the bottom line is, when I go back to my constituent groups and I say we have an Oregon health plan that provides medical services for individuals without resources or under a certain poverty level, that I can say with some degree of certainty that the stewardship and financial accountability of that program is at a level higher than what we would expect, or at least the same expectation we have for private corporations.
Okay. Let me see if I can take that in a couple parts. The first part is with regard to our role in this. What we feel our role in the audits division with regard to this area is to help kind of in two fashions. One is to identify and help find those systemic fixes to some of these issues. And so that was really the focus of this audit, was to take a look at what are things that we can do systemically to improve the process so we can move forward and get good information in the future. And you know, we feel that we went through and got some guidance from the federal government in this area. They lay out really four basic areas with regards to encounter data that states should be doing. And maybe if I can read really quickly a quote that comes out of the guidance. It says, before encounter data can be usefully employed for management or policy decisions, stakeholders in the system must be confident that the data are complete and contain accurate information. no data source should be considered accurate unless data quality assessments have been conducted. And so what we did is we looked at, are those data quality assessments being done here in Oregon to ensure that the data is there?
Well, let me ask you this. The Congress did recently pass legislation that applies to private corporations with respect to the financial accountability and representations that they make to the public about the financial position of a private corporation. Do we have anything of that nature where our agency managers have to respond to a report or a document that says this is, in fact, the true status of financial condition of this organization?
Mr. Chair, we do have the state's annual financial report, and that for us is the equivalent. We have the same
document. But do we hold, and I think that the focus of the federal legislation is to hold the board or the CEOs of corporations accountable for signing a document saying this is in fact what this corporation is worth or not worth, or how well we're doing with respect to the equity markets. We have nothing of that same nature that would hold agency managers accountable for how they represent the financial position of the agency.
I'm not aware of anything.
Senator Fisher.
You know, this is something that I've talked about several times. It's rather interesting how a private industry that works and gets the remuneration from the government has to have all of its records in order, has to do all kinds of things that are not relative to any type of reasonable financial statements or anything else. They have to stand on their head. There's no recognition that this costs money or anything else. People come down and sit in your business for several days, rummaging through anything and everything that they want to. You're responsible for every penny item or nickel item or whatever the case might be all through your business, and all of a sudden the state can't do this. It's too expensive for the state to do this, and yet the state gets paid times over what we get paid in the private sector for the same services and that kind of thing. It just boggles your mind. Not only that, we're subject to all kinds of fines, all kinds of sanctions, and that kind of thing in the process if we make a mistake. And we come up here, and then somebody shrugs and said, well, man, this is only 2% of our whole total thing. Why, we're doing a great job. That doesn't cut it when you're working with Medicare or Medicaid out in the private sector. And it just seems like that there needs to be some kind of handle on things so there's a little fairness in this issue. Somebody's bungling up and losing money at the state level, they ought to be responsible in the same category and the same quality of stuff that we're responsible for in the private sector if we bungle up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I do want to make sure that I didn't get misinterpreted. The state does have financial reports that are audited every year by our office. We're held to the same audit standards that private sector audit firms hold themselves to, which is under scrutiny, but we have a lot of confidence, though, in the state's comprehensive annual financial report. The information in that report is materially correct. And you can count on that and rely on that decision. What we have here, though,
is. Sure, I think you're sidestepping what I have said here. I'm not talking about the fact that you have this financial debt and you have clear. It doesn't go back to the point and say that there isn't money lost or there aren't things that are done. And your report showed that there were people on this plan that should not be on this plan. Do you think we would get paid and we would get lauded for the fact that we only had 2% of the people out there that we were billing for that were not supposed to be billed for? We could have the exact penny. And it's the exact person. We have one person on it that we billed for. That's fraud.
Mr. Chairman?
Right. Very old.
Mr. Chairman, when this audit first originated, I went and met with Ms. Polino and other members of her staff. And the reason I did that was because I thought that I'd only ever seen one other audit that was more damning in my relatively short career in the Senate than this audit. And I just want the members of the committee to understand the full import of what's in this audit. With all due respect to Senator Crow, who I respect greatly, there isn't any possible interpretation that the error rate is so small that we shouldn't bother to look at it, because correcting it might create such a tiny amount of savings that wouldn't justify looking harder. Colleagues, this report basically says that this agency violates federal guidelines. it does not have the adequate data that is required under HCFA regulations. And if you doubt that, look at page 3 in the center column. In the first paragraph under the headline, certain steps needed to detect and prevent significant data errors. It says that according to guidelines provided by the Federal Government's Health Care Financing Administration regarding use of encounter data, quote, before encounter data can be usefully employed for management or policy decisions, stakeholders in the system must be confident that the data are complete and contain accurate information. HCFA also notes no source data should be considered accurate unless data quality assessments, quote, system edits, analytical reviews, and medical chart reviews, have been conducted. Quite simply, this program fails to meet HCFA guidelines. It is not a legal program. The lack of data and the lack of internal audit controls creates a system of cost shifting between plans and HMOs. It's no small thing that a 5% error could produce a $65 million shortfall. The report suggests that this agency is seriously challenged and could not possibly meet adequacy in terms of standards and management without quality controls on their encounter data. There is no system at all in place for prescription drug data control or assessment. None. And prescription drugs account for a significant portion of the expenses for the Oregon Health Plan, and there are no controls in place for auditing prescription drug data. It's not required by the program. It isn't defined by the program. It isn't tested. It isn't audited. And yet it's a significant portion of the cost of the Oregon Health Plan. Virtually everywhere the agency, the Secretary of State's auditors looked, they found potential fraud or waste. In one instance, in a situation where a lab was unbundling services, and if that's not a defined term for people, in the situation where you'd have a chest x-ray and read, that goes under one code for the Oregon Health Plan. And if those services are provided, they should be billed as a separate, or as a single service, the chest x-ray series and the interpretation. The one lab that they looked at routinely offered the chest x-ray as a single service, and then later, or at a different date or at a different time, offered the expenses for the interpretation. And the change in amount could be from $15 for the total service to over $200. And in the one instance that they looked at, it resulted in a referral to the state police for fraud investigation. In other instances, discharge dates are misreported. So essentially, we're paying for services to phantom patients. My understanding is that of the total population of the Oregon Health Plan, only a tiny fraction of these files were reviewed, less than 300. Out of the total served population in the many tens of thousands. And the indications were so bad that essentially there's no way that you could conclude otherwise than that the Secretary of State concluded that inadequate encounter data controls could be putting the Oregon Health Plan at risk of program failure. Now, that is not a small conclusion to make, that it's such a significant problem that the encounter data is so bad that the lack of prescription encounter data, that the review of a tiny fraction of these files resulted in an assessment that could indicate up to 5% of the loss out of this program, indicates that this program has been operated essentially without usual and customary accounting procedures and controls. And as far as I know, the department agrees with this audit. Essentially, the Department of Human Services generally agrees with the recommendations. So I don't see how you could agree with the recommendations without agreeing with the conclusions of the audit. And the interesting thing about this is that this audit was done in a relatively short period of time with a relatively narrow focus, with what I would consider a statistically invalid amount of file review. They only had 300 files, and what's the total population of the Oregon Health Plan? Does anybody know that number?
450,000
files. And so I guess I would suggest to you that this is a very serious indictment of the ability of this program even to meet minimum federal requirements to operate. And so to suggest that the expense of reviewing the data would hardly justify the result is a conclusion I can't get to.
I just can't get to that. I only asked the question, is that the case? To find out whether it is enough. So don't put words in my mouth.
Senator Carl, I respect what you're saying. What I have heard is the same commentary from the managers of this program. Is it worth looking at? Well, I'm going to tell you, it's worth looking at. And I think this committee, if it does nothing else, should strongly recommend to the Secretary of State that they be allowed to shine their light elsewhere in the Oregon Health Plan, because the fact is, everywhere they look, there were serious shortfalls.
I appreciate your comments, and I'm sure that you didn't mean to put words in Senator Carl.
I did not. I apologize.
Okay. Ms. Leno, does the Secretary's office have copies of all of the data and information that you reviewed for the audit?
Mr. Chair, it kind of went down and you're talking about, because a lot of the information is held by PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is the actuary that does a lot of this review. We did take a download of a portion of that and ran through analytical tests.
All right. You have copies of that data and information. Could you make that available to this committee?
Mr. Chair, it would depend on what you need, because we're talking about a massive database.
Well, I think we can handle a massive database. We have certified smart PhDs that work with this kind of stuff. I think we can handle it.
Sure. Could we have Ms. Polito respond to the Senator's statement of how big a problem do we have as far as you're concerned from the basis of your audit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, a very difficult question for me to answer, because the what we don't know is we could be actually right on, but we don't know that because the quality of the information has never been tested as far as taking it back to the medical center, because that's really what needs to have to happen to get a good handle on the quality of the encounter data.
Do we know whether the quality of the encounter data here is worse than in any other state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, our understanding is that everybody struggles with this problem. But what we know here about Oregon is that, you know, again, the small percentage off is because of the size of our program here in Oregon makes a huge dollar amount. But that next test that would need to happen is that matching to medical.
Okay. What do we need to do to have a better understanding of the problem? What else can you do to help us have a better understanding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, again, that analysis is the next thing that we have to have happen. Mm-hmm. We do have Senator Fisher as the co-chair of the audit committee, and Senator Farioli is also a member of that committee. What we like to do and what we're hoping is to be able to take requests for audit and funnel them through the committee, because we do have a number of other requests that are coming in. Mm-hmm. We need to somehow have some mechanism to prioritize these things. And so I guess my suggestion would be to have this come before the audit committee meets October 16th at the next Washington meeting, so that we can kind of have a discussion of that in light of the juvenile justice audit we've been asked to do, and the 911 emergency funds, and the Measure 66 water settlement. We have all those audits in our pocket right now. And so that would tend to me to be the next logical step, is to let's take it to the committee and maybe talk about prioritizing some of those.
All right. Are you finished, Senator Carl?
Well, do we need more information before we analyze where we are? Analysis is important, you say. We haven't had analysis yet.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carl, I think, again, to answer that question on how far off are we, you would need to have an additional analysis. And we could work on putting together maybe what that would take to get there.
Would you need a larger statistical sample than 300?
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that that's there, too. 300 is on the second audit, the sample type that we took. So this particular audit, we did some analytical reviews, which is high level across the board looking at the data, pulling bundles and looking at different codes that way. So in order to do that statistical sample again, we didn't go and do medical chart reviews for this particular audit. But what we saw was indications of the same problems that they have with the fee-for-service program, which is something that we've audited in the past, and you know, we've done some medical chart reviews and found problems.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. I'm a policeman. Based on what you've found, is there a reasonable belief that there's a problem in terms of some of the collection of data and what it represents in terms of...
Yes, I think that's a very valid statement.
All right, so a reasonable person would conclude that there is, in fact, a problem here that needs to be rectified, notwithstanding how complex it may ultimately be.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make clear that the failure is not among the people running this program. The failure is in the systems and the controls that we put in place for them to do their job. For instance, we don't have a mandate for this agency to do anything about prescription drug data. And that is a blind spot that costs hundreds of millions. We also have not given them a mechanism to reconcile different data platforms. So you've got a whole stream of data coming in from HMOs and a different stream of data coming in from healthcare providers and a different stream of data coming in from managers as they make their disbursements on this program. If those systems are incompatible, they simply throw the data out. And the problem with that is that we're using the feedback data to set actuarial. And so huge gaps of information that could create course corrections and trim the sales on this program are not even being equated. They're not being correlated. They're not being considered. So I guess I want to make clear that the failure is in systems, but the indicators are that we are spending money in places and we're not aware of where the dollars go.
No, and I would also assume that by, and the assumption is that we're spending, we could potentially be spending more money than we need to spend rather than not spending enough. No, or is it both?
See, Mr. Chair, that's the tricky part, is it could go either way.
So it's really both, and we just simply are flying blind.
Senator.
And, Mr. Chair, that's precisely why I asked my question, because in the absence of that data, you can't tell if you have a pool of 5,000 people out there and it's a group that some HMO is providing care for. If your statistic's off 0.1%, it means the difference between life and death for that particular organization is providing the health care. I guess what I've listened to for the last half an hour are a lot of questions that have bubbled to the surface that, honestly, the legislators don't have time to think about, and so I'm not convinced as to whether the problem lies with managers of the health care plan, with the fact that maybe they can't keep up with the data that comes in, too much data comes in, and maybe they're not staffed well enough to be able to handle it, or whether the various providers out there haven't been educated well enough provided, or whether the problem is ours. Did we not create a plan that's well enough described in law or whatever for people to go out and set up the regulations to set up the right kind of plan or to have the right controls in place? So I hear what Senator Ferrioli is saying, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure that certainly we don't have enough data to even know where to point the fingers if we're going to start pointing fingers.
Right. And I actually think that's a good point. I think there's enough culpability, and I don't mean to say blame in a negative sense. I'm just saying that there's enough lack of information going on for everybody. I would suggest that, at least in my framework of thought, the federal government does have specific standards. They do, from time to time, audit these programs, and these agencies do have general rulemaking authority, notwithstanding, you know, the laws created by the legislature based on, you know, flowing from those laws are administrative rules. The agency has a wide latitude, for the most part, in creating administrative rules to administer a program and do so in a fiscally sound manner. So I think the statements made yesterday by Senator Ferrioli and my are really, are to try to make this program better and to make it work better and to provide better information. That's to the extent that you have, say, overpayment, you also have people who cannot access the system, perhaps, because those resources are being consumed by someone else that they shouldn't be. Mr. Taylor, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Polino, could I direct your attention to page 2 of your report, unreported income not always identified? And I read that to be eligible, a family of four has to make under $1,471. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, at the time of our audit, yes. I'm not sure what the current.
So if a family makes $1,472, they're not eligible?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And if the family has someone who's pregnant, if they make under $2,500, they're eligible, but if they make a dollar above, they're not. Is that correct? Now, I noticed in the report, I assume you did that because of time elements and the ease of auditing within acceptable standards, you used a figure of 125%. So you only counted those who are 125% above the income level.
Mr. Chair, that'd be correct. We were looking for a high-risk pool to do our audit. That's not what we did.
Can I back up, Mr. Chair, because what you're talking about right now is the second audit that we haven't given you kind of the update.
Oh, okay. Everyone here. Okay.
We can maybe give you that background first. That might help answer some of those
questions. We'll hold the question.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, my last question on this topic anyway. I think Senator Shields points out an excellent observation, and that is that we really don't know whether or not it's a system failure or structural errors or problems that are built in, whether that's a lack of control mechanisms and management in the agency, or whether that's a lack of oversight from the legislature. And so that's our responsibility. What we do know is that this audit says this program fails to meet the federal guidelines. That's what we know. This program fails to meet minimum federal standards.
Yes. Mr. Chair, just also in this report, what we have here are things that are within the state's power here. We weren't looking at oversight questions, policy questions. What we're looking at is managing this program. What are some practical things that the state agency can be doing in order to get it for you?
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Secretary of State's office on this topic? Now we're going to transition into the second
one. Mr. Chair, for the record, Dan Schechtebner, Deputy Director of the Audit Division. And I'll go ahead and walk you through some of the points in the eligibility, final eligibility review we did. First of all, I wanted to give a little bit of perspective. At the time of our audit, anyway, the total biannual budget was $2.5 billion. What our audit focused on was eligibility determination process for the newly eligible, for those that were not categorically eligible for other programs, but thereby being also eligible for Oregon Health Plan benefits. So focusing on the newly eligible, which is basically a mail-in process, we look at just the branch in the north end of town and their processes for handling those eligibility requests. Within that, we did think one of the major drivers of eligibility is the wage, the income level. Mr. Taylor was bringing the point the different income levels in order to be eligible. So what we decided to do was to look at a high-risk population of folks that may have too much income to actually qualify. So we employed...
You said high-risk. What do you mean by high-risk?
In order to get at the pool of applicants we wanted to look at, we took the employment wage database and matched it with folks that were at that time on benefits. And by doing that, we would have gotten a population that was just huge. So what we decided to do for audit purposes was to pick a level 125% above what the minimum income level would be, or the maximum income level would be, to perform our audit test for a random sample on. So we picked 125% in excess of whatever that is. Yeah, level would have been.
Right, and you did that because you were...
Because we wanted to narrow the population of folks that we were looking at, and basically we were testing the controls over wage determination, so we felt that the way to maximize our time and our effort was to actually identify those that were
statistically a higher risk of being in violation. So
let me go back to Mr. Taylor then and ask him to complete his question.
Mm-hmm.
At this point,
once again, going back to this particular page, so what you're saying is, even though there were people who were ineligible,
which page again?
Page 2 of the report, Mr. Chair. Middle column, unreported income. Cases with adult members who have high wages and a significant rate of error. Those are the two topics involved there.
Okay.
So what you did is you looked only at those at 125%, even though there was a population that were from 100% to 125%.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it that that would probably be a significantly larger population than the population 125% and over.
That would be safe
to say. So I guess what I'm getting at is, then you say we estimate the annual cost of providing coverage to eligibles in the high-risk population was $2.1 million. So I take it that's an extremely conservative number. Would that be correct?
That would be statistically relevant to that population.
To that population.
Certainly the most, those not the people that would have fallen within the 100 to the 125% range. We wouldn't have enough.
Could it be a safe assumption that given the probable larger population between 100 and 125%, that of those who are receiving benefits but actually ineligible, would be a substantially larger sum of money, would it not? I mean, that would be followed by a reason, wouldn't it, much as anything?
Mr. Chair, the problem we have is that you can't project also to that population.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get closer to that poverty limit, there might be some reasons they might be going back and forth over that line. So we looked at a slice of time and said that they are currently at this time making more than 125% of poverty level. There is a large population that's between 100% and 125% at that
mm-hmm.
slice of time that we looked at, but they may have had that income for that one quarter, but then been off the next quarter. And so what we did is we kind of narrowed the pool to look at it. We have this whole population. We have a smaller portion that has some reported income totally, and then we also have another portion that has high income. And so that's the price of the program.
Nonetheless, it's a bright line test. You either qualify or you don't qualify. And would it be safe to assume that as some people go below the line, other people go above the line, and economic times are good, more people go below the line, or go above the line than below? So
if there is that population that's between 125% where there would be additional ineligible.
And let me put it this way, that number is not factored into your estimate.
That would be
correct. Even though it's probably a fairly significant number.
That's correct.
Thanks.
Okay, let me follow up on that for just a second. How large was the pool of individuals that you identified with incomes over 125%?
Was it the 14?
Mr. Chair, 4,400 cases we found had above 125%.
All right, but you simply did not look at those that would be $1 to at least. Okay.
Mr. Chair, when we were doing the audit, we actually took each case that we took as a sample mm-hmm. and went all the way back into the case file to make sure of what we were seeing. So we had to select a number that was doable, so we're not statistical based.
Yeah, I understand. I'm not trying to impute any wrongdoing here or
no.
evil here. I'm just saying that I think Mr. Taylor's question and your answer is at least reasonably accurate. You don't know the specific number that pool of individuals between 100% plus whatever margin over to 125% is a fairly significant pool of individuals. But again, you suggested that sometimes their incomes would fluctuate from month to month, which is reasonable. Can we know whether or not the federal government allows for that fluctuation?
Mr. Chair, I think that'd be a great question for these folks on the rules on eligibility.
Okay. All right. Next one. Any other questions? You want to continue, sir?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. So as we looked at our population that are not fall in the high risk category, we did pull 60 of those, and we found that 15 were actually not eligible, and that's how we came to our statistical projection. While we were working through the wage match process, we did note that Social Security number was an important component of income eligibility and kind of the monitoring of that eligibility, especially if you're doing such things as wage matches or comparing to other benefits or other databases. So we did have a comment in there on the fact that there was a percentage of individuals actually on the plan that should have had Social Security numbers and didn't, and also commented on the fact that those there were a number of folks in the household whose income needed to be considered that also did not have Social Security numbers in the system. So we felt that was something that was, could be correctable and would certainly help enhance the monitoring of the program.
All right.
Within that same vein, there is a premium waiver allowance whereby upon redetermination, if an individual has no income at the time of redetermination and they hadn't paid their premium, which in this program is somewhere between $6 or more was required of each individual, each group to pay as far as a co-payment. They could be waived upon redetermination if there's no income. So we looked at those instances where there were waivers based on no income, where we had actually evidence that there was some income coming in, and found that either it was a documentation issue because they could waive for reasons other than no income, but the waiver was for no income and it's certainly evidence that there was income. So we asked them to revisit that process and see if indeed there's some things that could be tightened there.
Okay.
On page 4 of the audit, we did get into some of what we thought was, could potentially be the contributing factor for some of the things we were seeing. Eligibility specialists not following their enhanced verification process, which does do some of the wage look back and some of the things that, that we end up recommending further on in the audit report. Specialists not reviewing prior eligibility determination. Case narratives do not support the basis for past waivers would increase the documentation in the case narrative. Did not investigate significant drops in monthly income. And they may have seen a pattern of pretty good income, and then upon eligibility determination, there was a drop in income, and not really investigating why that, or at least not documenting why that would be the case. And the Social Security number issue that I had discussed before. And then went on to have some specific recommendations to help improve those controls. The other issue that we looked at was the non-citizen issue, and in terms of full coverage,
Senator Shields.
Hey, before you go to non-citizens, I began to think over here, well, probably the worst job in the world must be to be an eligibility specialist. How many of those folks did you talk to? And, is it just that, quote unquote, they did not always follow OEHP's enhanced verification process, or is it that they had such a big backload of work to do that they're running like crazy to catch up? Can you give me any
Mr. Chair,
light on that?
At the time we were trying to track down some of these cases, we did work very closely with DHS staff, and we were aware that there was a significant caseload for a caseworker. That seemed it was the question of manageability, whether that would be something that could be done effectively and efficiently. And I certainly sense that was part of the challenge for their folks was to keep up with things. They've got, they had backlogs that come and go, but they certainly seem to be working hard in doing that. So that was indeed an impression we got.
Mr. Chair, this might be interesting to talk to some people off the line there. I've never talked to this particular kind of eligibility specialist, but I've been in what you used to call a welfare office and just been out front and been watching eligibility determination and looking at the timelines and the crush of the work coming through the front door. I've done that up in the St. John's area in Portland, and I've done it in my own district and so on. And it would be interesting to maybe get that perspective, too.
I was going to add that being a police detective isn't exactly an easy job either, but
yeah,
still
right.
It's a very high standard of responsibility. Senator Crowe.
As you dealt with the people who were trying to determine eligibility, did you feel that they had the requisite training to do that well? Is that, we can hire specialists to supervise people who do that, or we can train people well to do that to begin with so that they're that the problems go away in a lot of instances. What about the training?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, as we talked with the folks in the division about the sort of things they do to try to help mentor and coach and train individuals, especially with the advent of the enhanced verification process, we certainly came with the impression that it is a focus for them to ensure that their specialists do have training. To the extent that was working as effectively as they would have liked it, That is the question. But I know that they have a program whereby they put them through training. They have a senior, I don't know if it's caseworker or whatever, assigned to that individual for a certain time reviewing work and so on and so forth, sort of things you'd expect to see.
Did you find that those situations where it was very marginal, whether you qualified because of your income and you had some very serious medical needs that needed an almost immediate attention, that had an effect on the decision-making?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, that wasn't something, that, at least in the sample that we selected, that wasn't something that was evident in the case files we reviewed.
All right, thank you. Representative Cruz was first, and Senator Farrelly, and then Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a matter of perspective, we added a significant number of new specialists this last session. And I did some very simple math on it. And if you take the number of, assuming that they hired everybody that we authorized, if you take the number of applications, people that are doing the applications, and divide it by the number of applications they receive, they would be allotted about an hour per case. That's neither. Look at the simple math, assuming it's 40 hour a week, that's the amount of time that is allotted per application.
All right, thank you. Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think we ought to tease apart some of these issues because I think they become emotional immediately. Everybody has a Social Security number. And for a program that makes a determination on income, how can you make a determination without verifying the income? So in the cases where the 20 or so files were pulled, which did not have a Social Security number, which did not have all of the household and family members' Social Security numbers, half of them were accomplished, that is, half of them were obtained with a phone call. But in those that were obtained, a significant portion of the numbers that were approved for eligibility were not eligible. And that's not, that has nothing to do with the residency issues, but I think we ought to look at that. When we say non-citizens, we're not necessarily talking about aliens. You know, I just love Idahoans. Because they come across the bridge and they spend a lot of money in Oregon to avoid taxes in Idaho. But they also come across the bridge and get a phony address and they hook up with the Oregon Health Plan. And Nevadans and Washingtonians, bless their little hearts, are in the Oregon Health Plan. And Oregon is noted as a state that has the most generous health program of the Western states. And there is a significant number of folks that are American citizens of neighboring states, moving to Oregon and not even establishing residency here and becoming eligible under the Oregon Health Plan. A more troublesome issue is the issue of serving illegal aliens and resident aliens who have not lived within the state or the United States for 40 quarters, which is prohibited by federal law. This program serves people who are not eligible for the program. That's a problem. A bigger problem is this program serves people in contravention of federal law. And I'm sure somebody in the department thinks that nobody will sue them over that illegal action. Detailed on page 5, non-citizens receiving full OHP benefits when prohibited by federal law. This is one of those issues where you can be globally compassionate or you can be compassionate. Our compassion is bankrupting the system. Nobody wants to turn somebody in an emergency situation away. And in fact, we don't do that. They go to emergency hospitals, and they're served, and the Oregon Health Plan pays. But these are eligibility determinations where people fill out a postcard and get on the Oregon Health Plan. Or they go to an office, and the intake specialist ignores the intake guideline for income, fails to get a Social Security number, approves people who are non-residents of the state of Oregon, even though they might be our neighbors in a neighboring state, or approves people who are not resident aliens who have 40 quarters, or 40 quarters, is it?
40 quarters.
40 quarters of residency in the United States for the plan. And they only pulled 300 files. And the potential error rate, I think they're being very conservative at 5%. I think if you look harder, you'll find more waste, fraud, and abuse. And it is a quality control issue, and there are not adequate quality controls within the agency. There's the desire to operate the program. We put the resources in the program to operate it, but it feels like we're holding a sieve here, and the problem is it is such a significant issue that it threatens the stability of the whole program. Now, the question is, are we going to be compassionate and just say, come one, come all, hey, Idahoans, Washingtonians, Nevadans, Jesus, you have to cross two state lines to get onto the Oregon Health Plan. You can have your Oregon Health Plan card that day. Or are we going to be a little more globally compassionate and realize we cannot provide services to people who are not eligible, because if we do that, we're going to bankrupt the system. That's the issue. It's a tough issue. But it's incumbent on us as policymakers to insist at this agency put the controls in place to serve the people who are eligible. How can I explain to people who are a couple of dollars over the line, who are the working poor, who cannot get eligibility, how can I justify the fact that we're putting people on this program who aren't even residents of the state of Oregon? And they only looked at 300 files. We just don't have any quality control in this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Taylor, and then Senator.
A quick question. I believe Mr. Gibbons probably can answer this. On page 2, you say you use the term significant rate of error. Significant mean 1%, 2%, 5%?
I'm sorry, what was that?
You use the term significant. Cases where at least one adult without recorded Social Security number had a significant rate of error, and you use the word significant throughout this particular section. Does that mean 1%, 2%, 3%?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I pulled 20 files, and of those 20 files, 6 of the households, I mean, you can look at the, you can do the fractions if you just look at the report. And significant means in some cases 50%, some cases 60%, but they only pulled a very tiny number of Social Security number files, only 20, I think.
Mr. Chair, for this particular test, we pulled 16 case files and 15 of 60. You pulled 60 and 15 of 60 didn't have the Social Security number.
Did not have 60. Correct.
That's correct.
15 of the
60. Mr. Chair, I wanted to maybe make one correction. We did do an audit test to look for those out-of-state folks that are receiving benefits here. The most common way that they do this is by obtaining a PO box here in Oregon. And so what we did is we did some tests on those PO boxes, and we found that there was not a problem in that area as far as people from out of state getting PO boxes and receiving benefits. Those that had post office boxes were Oregon residents. We did that test.
Everyone?
We were looking around the border.
Yeah, we didn't find anyone. Specifically the towns along the borders, we were collecting a random sample of PO boxes and weren't able to identify.
So you didn't find the same statistical problem with Social Security numbers?
Not in the, at least that particular method.
But you spoke about PO boxes as opposed to street address.
Yeah.
We didn't do verification of street addresses, whether they were
Once we identified the PO box, then the next step would be to ask the agency, and they went out and identified it. Well, we also had the postmaster. We found the street address and found no aberrations.
Mr. Chairman, the largest rate of error is on a face-to-face interview.
Senator Fisher.
There have been some reports to me that people are coming in and getting a relative to build their electrical bill to them at their address and that kind of thing. Did you make any checks for that type of situation where somebody maybe didn't have Oregon driver's license or a voting card or anything like that, voter registration.
Senator Fisher, that wasn't one of the tests.
According to the information that I get, it's not very hard for somebody to come from out of state and have a relative here in Oregon and have one of their bills or something switched over and billed to them for a period of time and using that address. And that bothers me because that's not a very hard thing to accomplish. And you just have no way of knowing if you don't check beyond that. And I have never understood why we don't require somebody, if they're on the Oregon Health Plan, to produce a driver's license that's here. If they had to come from out of state and change and give up their driver's license, they had to come and register and be a registered voter here and make the changes and things like that that would require, that would be a significant deterrent, I would think, to somebody just coming here for a short time and inveigling a relative to let them act like a citizen of Oregon, and we wouldn't have any way of telling it short of going and requiring some of these things. Also, Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up with the Social Security number, it doesn't say why these Social Security numbers, these people aren't required, this call-in program and stuff like that. Is that not a federal standard that doesn't require that, or is that just the state not bothering to do it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, there's really two aspects to this. One is that if an individual that is being provided the benefits, they are required to provide a Social Security number. For those individuals that are in the household unit where their income is supposed to be considered for eligibility of others in the household, that is not a requirement that the Social Security number be provided.
Why? And who doesn't require this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I believe that goes back to what the agency has heard from the federal government in terms of requiring individuals to provide Social Security numbers when they aren't actually being provided benefits. It gets down to requiring versus requesting or asking.
Did you do any analysis with respect to Social Security numbers that may be fraudulent?
Not in those terms. I mean, certainly had questions as to whether the Social Security number was accurate after we did some wage matches, and the names may not have matched the records that were either in employment or at DHS.
Oh, okay. Of the individuals who did actually have Social Security numbers, did you have a percentage of individuals who you had questions about whether or not the number was accurate to that individual?
We did do some tests in that regard. We went to the Social Security number database to verify names, because once we had done our test, we weren't sure where the name error was on the employment data side or on the department side. And actually, we found that the department's name and Social Security number match was pretty good. There were a couple instances where we did refer back to the agency to follow up on, but for the most part, their name and Social Security number match was pretty good.
All right, good. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Well, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it, and appreciate your objectivity in doing the audit. All right. Who's next? Okay. I guess we're going to bring Lynn Reed, Gene Thorne, who's coming back from having done something else for quite a number of years, and is Sue Aver, Vicki Green.
Mr. Chair, Jean Thorne, I'm still in the governor's office this month, and I'm here as the OHP 2 project director. I will be returning to OMAP as administrator on an acting basis beginning October 1st. And so with me is Lynn Reed, who's the assistant administrator, Hirsch Crawford, who's current administrator, is retiring the end of the month, but he is not here. Sue Abrams and Vicki Green are from other parts of the Department of Human Services, I'm not sure which they are, and would be available to respond to the eligibility audit if you'd like to first do that, and Lynn and I can talk about the issues around flexibility in the health plan with the health plan two waivers. I'm not sure how you'd like to.
Right, we've kind of got the cart before the horse, and et cetera, but it's such a huge program that I don't know of any other way to do it. Why don't we go ahead and have some response to the audit, because I know the committee is going to have some questions with respect to the response and what the follow-up has been a response to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sue Abrams with the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families, Office of Prevention and Transition of Benefits.
Mr. Chair, I'm Vicki Green, Program Manager for the Oregon Health Plan Statewide Processing Center with the Department of Human Services, Community Human Services.
Could you share with us briefly your background and your employment with the state? How long have you been with the state? And what positions have you held generally? What areas are you responsible for?
Mr. Chair, how long have I been with the state? Probably about 25 years, and I have managed the policy pieces of the Medicaid program and other programs that have been in what were previous organizations called Adult and Family Services. And that's how I've been at a line level position, we weren't called case managers, but then I did that. And eligibility workers, and I've been a supervisor and now I'm an administrator.
All right, so thank you. That's helpful. And,
Mr. Chair, I'm Vicki Green, and I've been in the state system for 32 and a half years.
Is that right?
Just counting. Yeah, and I started out as a clerical person and moved up through all the ranks and have been in the field up until 97, in which time they put me in the Oregon Health Plan as the program manager.
Now, were you forced to go there, or did you ask?
I was asked to go there.
All right.
But you loved it, and I learned it.
All right. Thank you. You want to go ahead and respond?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I know that audit is kind of complex as they go through the details, so what I was thinking is we tell you kind of the actions we put in place to deal with the majority of the pieces that were of concern. And Vicki can talk a lot about the details, but she works directly with the branch and the processes.
Before you get started with that, just another one of my thoughts. Do you happen to have access to financial accountability individuals, people that do your accounting, financial data processing within the agency to respond to some of these questions? Because maybe the questions really revolve around the input of data into a computer system, I assume, and how that collection of data occurs. Or are you the ones that open
it? The eligibility.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Excuse me. Sorry.
I was completely lost on that.
If you thought I was confused before, now you know I am. So there you go.
So, Mr. Chair, we're going to talk about the eligibility audit. The part that happened at the Oregon Health Plan Central Processing Branch. So, and a couple things. One is around the policy piece that we were not following the federal policy around the 5-year ban on non-citizens. We have changed that policy. We consulted with the federal level. And part of what becomes complex is that we also have a lot of the staff who do eligibility deal with many different programs. And at the same time, the Medicaid the policy was changing at the federal level. It was changing for a host of programs, food stamps and TANF. And they all had a little different interpretation and a little different way of implementing this. So we did clarify with the federal agency that for Medicaid, we were incorrect in our policy, and we have made those changes, and they're out in our rules and in our policy manual.
Did you happen to have correspondence between your office and the federal government?
Yeah.
Could you provide copies of that material to the committee?
Yeah, we can provide that.
Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know as a result of the change, did anybody track the potential savings or the actual savings that were a result of the changes that were made?
Senator Farioli, I don't think we have specifically tracked them. I know that in the audit there was an estimate of what the potential might be. I think they found in those cases that were pulled there was one person that may not have been past qualified based on that federal law. But I don't have that figure. I don't think we'd be able to track that. But what we could give you is that over a period of time, as we find people who are denied for that reason, we could provide that information.
I think that would be at least helpful. I guess I would be curious, certainly if caseworkers went through their files and found ineligible, they would have to notify those folks that they were not eligible.
If they found it, yes, that's true. If they found somebody who was ineligible, that would discontinue benefits.
Thank you.
dispensers?
So we did change that piece of the policy, and then any new people who are coming in or as we review eligibility, then folks that we found were ineligible because of that change, they would no longer receive benefits. The major piece was around income and tracking of income, and in your packets, I think you'll find some of the material we have to do that. One is a pending notice, so it's just a blank one. But we use that if what we find is information is questionable, income information is questionable, there's a drop in income, and we need some further information from previous months, now the reporting is off in income. Then we follow up, and that pending notice is part of what we use to inform clients that we need additional information, and we'll be pending you until we get that information. The other piece is that we're doing a more thorough job of following up on some of what the Secretary of State's office identified were areas where we needed to do more follow-up. And so what you see there is kind of it's a rough form because it was it's really a computer-generated form that people use. It's on our system. It's called a track narrative. But what we provided you with is the template, and then it goes through all those areas where an eligibility worker needs to respond specifically on the narrative saying they followed up. For example, there were concerns about waiving premiums, and maybe it was unclear if they really met the criteria for waiving premiums. That needs to be narrated and documented on that narrative now to assure that we're following that policy correctly. And then there's additional pieces around income, following up on income. Around Social Security numbers, our requirement is that to be on the health plan, you need to provide a Social Security number or you need to provide proof that you are applying for a Social Security number. Oftentimes, the people who don't have those Social Security numbers are newborns, because it takes a while for that process for the application process to happen. I think what the auditors were referring to, where there's a concern, and we do share that concern, but we're prohibited by federal law from requiring a Social Security number of somebody who's not specifically receiving benefits, but whose income we use to count or to determine eligibility for the people who are receiving benefits. So we might have parents who aren't eligible, but their children are eligible, and we need the parents' income to determine eligibility. We can't require that they provide us with their Social Security number, but we do have a lot of mechanisms we use to get that as best we can. One is we provided in our application process an opportunity for them to voluntarily provide the number to us. Another is that we do need to get verification of income. Oftentimes that's a check stub, and that will have their Social Security number, and when we get that information, we'll put that on our system, so we'll have that. So those are sort of the mechanisms that we have at our disposal to be able to do this legally.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I don't know if it's been made clear to the committee why a drop in income is a significant issue. And it's my understanding that the value of the Oregon Health Fund would be comparable to $375 a month if you were to seek comparable coverage in the private sector for a family. And that if a family's income in one quarter exceeds the requirements for eligibility, that it makes no sense to continue to work at a $6.50 job and jeopardize a $350 a month benefit. So people routinely miss work or even leave a job in order to keep the eligibility on the Oregon Health Plan. So there's a sort of a perverse incentive that we've built into the system that's particularly pernicious in terms of people, the working poor, people who are working and struggling to make ends meet and who have eligibility. As they progress in their job and do better and get pay raises, if that's possible, they may be jeopardizing their eligibility under the Oregon Health Plan. And we put people in the situation of having to make a choice of keeping their health coverage or keeping their job. And so many of them choose not to work because the benefit, obviously they'd have to work half a month in some cases to make up that benefit.
Okay. Senator,
You mentioned that your policy has changed after the audit and the eligibility. The eligibility caseworker, do they have, are they going back in files that previously have been authorized to provide health, the Oregon Health Plan to individuals and checking those to see if those comply, or are you just doing it with new enrollees?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Carnell, we generally, when we have policy change like that, it could be not feasible to go back and review every case. So we usually do it at recertification, and we do it if it comes to our attention. So if somebody's working a file, and that will come to their attention, but generally it's at the recertification.
And recertification is how often?
It is it's every 6 months.
6 months. Thank you.
All right. You have more of a presentation.
Mr. Chair, the only other thing I wanted to add is that we did, as part of the follow-up to the audit, we did, in many areas that were of concern, we provided quite a bit of training to the staff at the Living Health Food Branch around that.
Let me ask you a question without naming the name of any particular employee if such exists, but in your opinion, did you find any of these individuals who were doing the screening who were willingly or knowingly signing people up for the Oregon Health Plan who they knew were not qualified or should have known they were not qualified?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that.
Mr. Chair, I would say no. If we had an employee who would do that, we'd certainly take action on that.
How do you monitor the interview process and how do you supervise or maintain, some understanding of quality control?
We not only have our quality control that does case reviews monthly and they pull so many samples, but we also have carved out, because of our program integrity, lead workers who do case reviews on all the workers monthly so they spot check, and they are required to do so many per worker monthly.
Do you, these stories come to me, and I don't believe that we should make legislation based on individual stories, but I do hear from time to time that caseworkers have told individuals to quit their jobs or change their employment in some way or have another child, for instance, or blah, 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 to qualify for these benefits. Have you ever heard of such a thing happening?
Mr. Chair, no, I haven't.
Never in your experience? Well,
not at Oregon Health Plan, no.
All right. Senator Gressa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another question, following up on the chairman's question about things you may have heard. Have you done any particular review of eligibility in the agricultural field in terms of eligibility? And specifically, some of the things, again, anecdotal that I've heard in the field from employers, actually, is a concept of a group of individuals who collectively would be ineligible, having payment for work delivered assigned to just one individual so that the others become eligible for benefits. Now, keeping in mind that the employer would be culpable there and knowingly was culpable, but in order to get the work done, perform those types of tasks so that a large group of individuals would be eligible under the income tax that would not have been eligible except for the fact that the payment was deliberately assigned to one person more so than others. Have you ever had any investigation of anything like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that doesn't sound familiar, and I don't know how we feasibly even identify that. We have, our controls are that we do matches with the employment division, and if people are underreporting their wages, we have that information. I'm assuming the employer needs to be reporting that information to the employment division, so we use those controls. But if an employer is fraudulent, I'm not sure that we have the ability to, and I don't know how we even know that. Now, if somebody reported a concern to us, we do have investigators who would investigate and such.
Okay, I guess my next question would be, to the best of your knowledge, have you ever had anybody report that, and have you ever had any investigations of that as to whether certain individuals were ineligible because of median income standard that perhaps is not accurately reported?
I'm not aware of that. I probably need to ask our investigation unit if they have.
I would be very interested in that, Mr. Sheriff.
All right. You actually raised a whole separate set of questions with respect to the process of investigations and
yeah.
How these things occur. I'm still a little curious. How many of these individuals work for your agency that do these screenings for the Oregon Health Plan eligibility specialists?
So how many have access to the screen?
No. How many people do you have an employee that actually review these applications and do the eligibility screening or testing? I'm assuming these documents.
How many eligibility workers?
These forms come in some manner or form. I know hospitals sometimes fill them out and they come into your office. I assume you do something with them then. I assume you have people who walk into Adult Family Services or some other agency office and say, I'd like to apply to the Oregon Health Plan. The form subsequently filled out, sent somewhere. So when it's sent somewhere, how many people do you actually have that review these things and then make, how's that decision-making process accomplished?
Mr. Chair, let me talk a little bit briefly about the process. When a client wants an application, they call a 1-800 number, and they get an application sent to them, and it's barcoded, has a little label on it. We scan that in and into our database, and we receive it in our office. Of course, there is hospital holds, there is outreach programs, and a variety of branch offices that also get applications, and they might process them there or send them to us.
Tell me about that. How does that happen? If you've got a patient in a hospital, comes in the emergency room, the hospital staff, they fill out the form or call the 1-800 number?
No, they fax it into us. We have four or five fax machines that work 24/7.
Okay, so they fax those forms in to you, and then what happens?
And then we take a look at whether or not they meet our emergency criteria, and if they do, we process them and start them in process right away.
Okay, the emergency criteria, is that some
different? It's in the OMAP manual. It's like the life-threatening limb, you know, all those medicines that would create a hardship for them. There is criteria, yes.
Okay, we'll have to get back to that. That sounds like it almost has a different test to it.
It is. That's the emergency criteria.
Okay, I'm going to switch to Senator Farrelly.
The spot checks, Mr. Chairman, how many are required of each worker on a monthly basis?
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrelly, that the lead workers are required to do at least 5 reviews on each worker. There's about 25 workers in each team.
Okay, so they're doing about, was that a month?
Yes.
So they're looking at 125 files a month.
Probably.
So at the rate of 125 files a month, how many years will it take you to look at every file?
A long time.
430,000 files. Mr. Chairman, the reason I mention that is because the audit implications to me are that every single file on intake has to be reviewed. You know, it just seems very clear to me that the implications of this audit is that quality control be done on every single intake. And if it's not done on every single intake, you really do not have a systematic process for doing these eligibility verifications. The other implication is that eligibility verifications, plan eligibility review, and encounter data have to be correlated. There's got to be a connection. I mean, the comment was, geez, eligibility people are completely lost when considering the whole problem of encounter data. But unless there's some correlation between intake and services delivered, then you really don't have a quality control system. And I'm going to suggest that if we don't have a much more systematic quality control system on intake, you'll never catch the curve of fraud and waste on this program. It's too big, and there should be something more systematic. Mr. Chairman, I have another question. This is a hypothetical question, and the panel can reserve the right not to answer it if they want to. Hypothetical.
That's your own turn.
Just go with me on the scenario. What would is a person eligible for the Oregon Health Plan if they're making $6.50 per hour on a 40-hour work minimum wage job?
Good math.
Sure, that'd be a lot of
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, I don't have the income standards in front of me, but some of it depends on how many people are in the household. So if you're talking one person
mm-hmm.
at minimum wage full time, how much is that a month?
$260 a week, so you'd be talking about $1,100 roughly a month.
Okay. No. Consensus is they wouldn't be eligible. We don't have, like I said, in front of us either the calculator or the standard.
So minimum wage worker would not be eligible.
The standard is 100% of poverty level, and I sort of recall that you are at minimum wage.
If I were a program, if I were a software developer, and I knew I had 50 jobs that would be permanent if the project were successful, but I hired 100 people at 30 hours a week for $6.50 a job, couldn't I sign up every single one of those workers to the Oregon Health Plan, help them do that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I'm assuming that an employer, I guess, if they figured it out, I mean, what we look at is income level and eligibility. And so if somebody was paid below our eligibility standards and they met all the other requirements, they'd qualify for the plan.
Okay. And then if my project were successful and I had to lay off half of the workers, of course, everybody knew going in that there'd only be jobs for half the workforce. Wouldn't all the people on unemployment also just automatically be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I'm not sure. It would probably, again, depend on how much income they have, what amount they get on their unemployment benefit.
Right. And I guess
that varies based
assuming a $6.50 an hour job and 30 hours a week of employment, I would guess that they would qualify. And the reason I bring this scenario up is because it was reported to me that there were, in fact, Washington County software developers who were hiring two times the number of people that they knew they had permanent jobs for at less hours than folks would need to break the income requirements and be ineligible. And part of the unspoken benefit package was they get automatic health care coverage. So they have a 30-hour-a-week job and health care coverage, and if they got laid off, well, they'd get unemployment and health care coverage. So I'm just going to suggest that in any system where you create a benefit stream, people will figure out how to exploit the benefit stream. And the job that we have is to try and figure out how to get the benefits to the people that have the real need. And Mr. Chairman, I want to make something just absolutely clear. In District 30, 40% of the people that I represent are eligible for DHR programs and services. 40%. It isn't an option for me whether or not this program stays solvent. It must. It has to. It has to deliver the services. So I want the folks from this program to understand how critically important it is for me to make sure this program is sustainable, because 4 in 10 of the people that live in my district are on a program currently or eligible for a program through the Department of Human Services.
Do we have any abstract analyses of people receiving benefits to the Oregon Health Plan? What percentage of recipients are employed? Or if so, to what extent are they employed? How many hours per week? Or what the average wage is of the person on the program receiving benefits?
Sure, we have that information. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Could you provide that?
So the numbers who are employed and then the...
Just give me as much data as you can. I am also interested in knowing how often people cycle through the program, whether they're once eligible for the program, how long do they stay on the program? I know you recertify them every 6 months, but is there a kind of a turnover? Like, I know that roughly 20% of my Senate district moves out of the district every 2 years. So I know I've got at least 20% of my district that are new registered voters when I go to run for election again. So that kind of data with respect to who these individuals are who are on the program. Any other questions from committee members? Senator Trove.
Now, I was wondering whether or not there are staffing problems that make it difficult to check the eligibility as well as you'd like. Are people the caseload's too big? What do you see in terms of how you're equipped to do this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, we, as you know, with sort of the freeze on being able to fill positions, and just the turnover we have at the Oregon Health Plan branch, the dilemma Vicki has at Mountain is they have 40 unfilled positions. So between the increase in applications that we've experienced over the last, during this year, and the shortage of staff, it becomes a lot more of a challenge to keep in place sort of all of the things that we have in place to assure quality. And Vicki can maybe talk more about the staffing issues.
So it's an issue for us to decide whether we give you the staff that you need right at the level where you're dealing with the eligibility problem, or whether we hire specialists to look after a staff that's inadequate to do it to begin with, and put another layer of people asking people to do something when there are not enough of them to do it.
Yeah, Mr. Senator, so we have actually in Vicki's group have looked at and made recommendations on a couple processes they believe would improve the quality control, but it would require additional staff. And some of it is identifying those high-risk profile cases and doing a more intensive review of those that right now they don't have the ability to do with the staff.
I really sympathize with what Senator Ferrioli is saying about the numbers of people who are really dependent upon this program, and we do want to make it work for those people and to get them the help they need, and that takes money, obviously. What we don't want to do with this program, though, is somehow or other make it so full of red tape and so bureaucratic that all the money goes to do that and the money doesn't get to the patients who need the money for the health care that they'd like to get. So I think we have to just watch and keep the balance in such a way that we can somehow or other deliver the service out there that's needed, and that's the health care.
Right. That's a good admonition. Still, time is running short, and I want to redeem the time. I'm still very interested in this application process, so perhaps at some point we can get we'll drag you back here and go through that.
Mr. Chair, I invite you all to come and take you a tour and a visit.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, Mr. Chair, we can get you. We do have an outline of the process.
Mm-hmm. But you have 40 unfilled positions. Is that correct?
About 40, yes.
And, okay, so is that in order?
Yes, the turnover is very high right now because people are, frankly, getting promotions and going elsewhere to work.
So, okay. Okay. Do we have, now there's a hiring freeze on. Are you subject to the hiring freeze?
We are, as far as just holding positions up to 90 days, but this morning we just got approval to start hiring sooner than the 90 days. We don't have to wait. So because of our turnover, I mean, we just get seven, interviewed, and now we got seven more that are leaving. So the turnover is very, very high right now.
All right. Senator Crail.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're putting this agency in a tough position, but we're also, in terms of public policy, going to have to make a tough decision, and that is this. Are we suggesting that we don't have the resources to do the quality control to make the savings to keep this program solvent? And if that's the case, we just have to think about it. There's potentially hundreds of millions of dollars at stake in quality control in this program. And we're saying we can't afford to do it. It's too big a job. And that, I don't think, is a question we should put on the agency.
Right.
We should require. Because the savings are there. And that's the only way this program is going to be sustainable, is if we put those quality controls in.
Vicki, are you ready to start your... I was thinking of the lady who was with you 10 years ago.
Senior moment.
In 1993, this dates me, but we were here in this room, actually beginning to fund the Oregon Health Plan, which will, I'll make a couple of comments so that you can understand where I'm coming from. If you recall, I was somewhat reluctant to fund the program
at that
time and had some significant questions about the financial accountability of the program and the fact that I was uncomfortable with the numbers and the ability to look at cash flow and how much this program ultimately was going to cost us. And I've got to tell you, 10 years later, I'm still grappling with those questions, and it's rather confusing, which is one of the reasons that I requested the ability to have this committee from the Senate President, because I do believe that there are very significant issues facing us. I agree with Senator Ferrioli that we should require financial accountability of not just this agency, but all state agencies. And there should be a way for legislators or the board of directors of all of these agencies to have the ability to speak positively into the success or failure of the program. So you're coming back, which makes me wonder if you're like, okay, and why you're doing this, because it is an overwhelming, very, very complex area of our functions in state government. So why don't you share with us what you're doing, where you're going, why you're doing it, and understanding all the questions we've asked before.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. And the reason I'm coming back is because I've had such fun doing education for a few years. I needed a bigger challenge, and that's to come back to the health plan. Yesterday, I didn't listen to all of these. Anyway. I did listen to a good portion of it. I know there are a lot of questions about the concerns of the rising cost of the health plan. What kind of changes are necessary in order for us to get a handle on this and to get more flexibility to be able to sustain this in the future? And actually that, I have been working part of my time in the last year, along with doing the education policy, on the new set of waivers with Oregon Health Plan too. And that's really designed to help us do that. And so I want to share some of that information with you. And I think a couple of comments that I believe John Britton made yesterday. We talked about the rising cost of the health plan, and that's also symptomatic of the rising cost of health care. We see it in all of our private businesses, the rising cost of health care benefits. And unfortunately, the Oregon Health Plan doesn't control health care costs generally. We try to do what we can to control the cost of the Oregon Health Plan, but we, as all other payers, are subject to the cost of medical care inflation. Be that as it may, this, we really are trying through these waivers to allow us and the legislature the flexibility to get some more control, some more tools to control that. Let me just tell you where we are in negotiations and run you through three charts. And as we go through those charts, I'll let you know where I think we are with the feds on those charts in terms of seeing flexibility. We did submit our waiver request at the end of May, May 31st, I believe. We had asked for approval by August 1st. It's September 5th. We don't have approval in hand. However, the terms and conditions, we received the first draft of those, 27 pages of federal requirements, along with, I think, a 10-page draft award letter that came to us in early August, and those have been the basis for negotiations over the last month. I want to say Hirsch Crawford isn't here, but he led the negotiations, and I think did a wonderful job. I personally was shocked at the amount of flexibility we are potentially in the federal government. The terms and conditions, we have not seen the final set of them. We won't see them until they actually come to us signed by Secretary Thompson or Tom Scully, who is the Administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They are wending, we're beyond negotiating at this point, or wending their way through the federal government board sign off. I would hope within the next week or two, I know the governor did talk to Tom Scully last week, just to let them know he didn't want CMS to be concerned about discussions that were going on here in the state around the budget and have that be caused to pull back on the waivers. So part of what I say today, I will try to give you as much information as I can, but I also want to caution that I want to be able to talk about the flexibility we might have, but I'm also very concerned since we don't have the waivers in hand that we don't create an enormous attitude that may cause us to not get those waivers.
That's a question. I mean, help me understand this. We've had kind of the backdrop of this whole thing has to do with the financial accountability and the status of the agency and the Secretary of State's office, and it's very, very clear that there are significant problems. So how do you avoid the alarmists?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, as I go through and I talk about the potential flexibility we might have in terms of how far we could reduce benefits without getting approval from the federal government.
But doesn't that just make the whole issue somewhat muddier? I mean, and help me understand this. We're kind of in the process of asking for flexibility and at the same time expanding the program, correct? Okay. But we're expanding the program that we don't have sufficient financial accountability in or controls in or however you want to state that. It would be like asking Enron to take on another function without first setting the foundation of the organization on solid ground.
Mr. Chair, I have not been in the details of some of the audits that have occurred, and I will do that as I get back into this job. I think the costs that have, the escalation of costs in health plan over the last few years have been related to caseload increases. They've been related to medical inflation increases as well. And certainly there is room for tighter controls. There always are questions of, are you going to spend $5 million to save $3 million? And those are legitimate issues we have to look at.
But that's conjecture at best, isn't it?
I think it is on both sides. And I think that we do have financial controls in place. I think the question is, can they be better? Yes, they always can be better throughout the environment. That's why we have the audit division to say where you can make them better. We require financial statements from our prepaid health plans. We receive counter data. I think what I heard this morning from Secretary of State's office is there are more processes that we need to look at to make sure that the data that's even coming in doing counter data is good. We don't know if it's off. I did hear a comment. We could be right on. We just don't know. And so I think the issue is there are some big, as you'll see as we walk through some of these pieces of information, there are some big savings we can get and we can get quickly. And so the question is through the new health plan waivers. And as we are doing that, we need to work on some of those other issues. If we don't move forward with some of the waivers, and as I get into it, I'll explain a little bit more what we're proposing. We are foregoing the savings we can get. And so perhaps I can walk through, there's three charts here, I just would like to walk you through.
Did you bring copies of the charts for us?
I think you
we have.
I think you,
oh, okay.
Yeah, there's three separate ones. I'm actually going to start with this one that's three bar charts. And I apologize because you're running around this morning making copies after copies. Just to make clear, and these haven't been updated for current caseload estimates. But on the Oregon Health Plan 2 waivers, what we are recommending or what we're proposing, and was actually part of House Bill 2519, are for the current Oregon Health Plan, really breaking it into two sets of clients with two different kinds of benefits. And then lastly, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, gaining federal match on that and making that part of the program. To give you a sense of what we are looking at, on the left-hand column is what we're calling OHP Plus. That's basically our current benefit structure with a prioritized list of health care services. Currently, that covers all the categorical people, covers pregnant women, and gives up to 170% of the federal poverty level. As part of this, and I'll get into the expansion in a minute, we are also proposing an expansion for pregnant women and children to from 170 to 185% of federal poverty level. And one of the things I need to make clear right off the front is for the federal government to give us the authority to reduce benefits for the group in the middle and to claim federal match on the program on the right, we have to show some level of expansion. And as I go into this, talk about how much might be enough or not.
We're going to break in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to bring you back at 3:30 if that would work with you for that board session. And I'd like you to come back and this whole financial issue bothers me. I also chair the Senate Budget Committee. It was tasked, this is the interim committee, it was tasked with the responsibility of trying to forecast out what the state's budget looks like or would look like 10 years out, given the same set of responsibilities.
And this actually plays a fairly significant role in that. And so when you mention raising eligibility to 185% of federal poverty level and doing these things, it would be helpful to have some graphs and charts and some ideas of how the agency would see that happening and what the cash flow situation is.
And Mr. Chair, actually, I think as we go through a couple of these other charts, you'll see how what some of those costs are versus the savings we'll be able to get from establishing a whole new benefit package for over 100,000 of those who are currently eligible.
Okay.
And we'll have a lower benefit package.
Right.
We'll be able to show you here's the savings from this, here's the cost for adding this amount. What we're constrained with here is that the federal government, in order to give us the kind of flexibility we're asking for now, is saying we're not just going to do this so you can save lots of state dollars. We expect that they're coming under fire right now. Frankly, the Bush administration is for the flexibility. We expect that there's going to be some expansion there as well. And so we'll show you the savings we would gather from having the flexibility, just even initially, and then there's potentially more we could do. The cost of the expansion for these different groups, but also some ability to maybe not expand as quickly or as much as we have projected, we potentially could capture some additional savings. We'll be able to show that to you with these charts for over the next couple of minutes.
All right. And I'll have to have some mercy on you because you are the incoming director. But I'm going to hold you to your word, and I would appreciate it if you could produce whatever documents or spreadsheets or whatever it is that you can do to help us understand this in a simpler form. Keep in mind, you know a lot more about this program than any of us ever dreamed of.
And Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is we can walk you through when we come back through what we do have here. And then my concern is I feel like after listening yesterday, there's probably a need to understand kind of some mega issues, and then we could get down at a future meeting into some of the more details.
That's good. And I think that's what we should do when we come back at 3:30 in this room, have you do that, kind of set that framework and background, and maybe I'll give you some more time to prepare. If you think you need to, probably do this standing on your head, stacking BBs, and give the presentation. But that way we'll allow you to lay that foundation, and then hopefully the members can hold their questions at that point and ask. We get deference to Representative Cruz, and you seem like a better statement or question.
Well, I was just wondering, because clearly the creation of the new waiver application was a collaborative effort, and you have now received response from the feds. I'm wondering who in the legislature has copies of that, and how is the legislature involved in crafting our response to the response?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we do not have an official response. We've had documents going back and forth and back and forth. I did update the Legislative Leadership Commission on where we were in negotiations. I think that was in early August.
But they haven't received, nobody in the legislature has seen any of the documentation that's been flying back and forth at this point.
We'd be happy to give you copies, but knowing it's not final, and you don't
right.
have final, we can give you the 27 pages and bring the, you know, the last set that we saw,
and
even a marked up copy.
Okay. I guess my point, Mr. Chair, is that if we were involved in the creation, we should be involved in the negotiation, and I realize it's an executive branch function, but we also had fairly clear directions from Tommy Thompson going into this thing that he wasn't going to consider anything that didn't have support of both the executive and legislative branches.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I believe both the Senate President and the Speaker did put 10 letters of support once this passed out of the emergency board at special meeting.
Okay. And in all due respect to the Speaker and Senate President, they haven't been deeply involved in this as some other members of the legislative assembly have been.
And they aren't coming back.
All right. We're going to come back at 3:30. And if you could bring back.
I'd like to get some information here on this list of co-payments. Under the restorative dental, it says graduated co-payments, 500 benefit limit. Could you give us the range of the
we can do that. There are several
questions.
All right. Is that okay with you? Let's go ahead and quit. Let people take a lunch. You can back up, regroup, and we will allow you, when we come back, to lay that framework without interruption and allow the last committee members to write down their questions, et cetera. And if you'll provide those documents for us, make sure they're labeled in some way that it's preliminary and not final or something.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, and we're going to be...
Mr. Chairman, before you do, I have promised the committee a copy of this article I was requesting to, and Rick's copying it out now, so at your pleasure.
All right.
Maybe things you agree with, maybe things you don't. But.
All right. Good topic for discussion, at least, then. And you might want to provide one for the agency, too. So. All right, we'll be in recess at 3:30. Thank you.